From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. This show is broadcast on radio stations across the country, including Simon Fraser University's CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby. I'm John Steinman. Over the past year, Deconstructing Dinner has spent an increasing amount of time focusing on the discussions that take place on food and farming within Canada's parliamentary committees. Specifically, we've focused on dialogue about the future of Canada's prison farms and on genetically engineered seeds. But today, we visit another discussion within a previously unexplored committee here on the show, the Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans. In the past few months, the subject of salmon farming has made its way into that committee and on multiple occasions. As part of our ongoing coverage on salmon farms through our Norway-British Columbia series, we'll be featuring some of that dialogue from Ottawa. Among the many members of Parliament who will hear posing questions, we'll hear statements and responses from biologist Alexandra Morton of the Raincoast Research Society, Mark Shepherd of British Columbia's Ministry of Agriculture and Lands, Lawrence Dill, a professor emeritus at Simon Fraser University, and from Craig Orr, the executive director of Watershed Watch Salmon Society. Salmon has and continues to be a really hot topic of debate and discussion lately, discussions about both farmed and wild salmon. For one, the regulatory regime of British Columbia's salmon farming industry continues to transition from provincial to federal authority. That following the successful 2008-2009 legal challenge of the province's authority over the industry. This transition is, of course, of interest to members of Parliament sitting on the Standing Committee of Fisheries and Oceans. And also of interest is the 2009 collapse of the Fraser River sockeye, when only 1 million of an expected 10 million sockeye salmon returned to the Fraser River. That collapse has led to a commission of inquiry named the Cohen Commission, which, led by Justice Bruce Cohen, will examine the collapse and make recommendations for the future sustainability of the fishery. Opening hearings of the commission will be held between June 15th through the 17th, and evidentiary hearings will then continue in September. Of course, among the many areas of concern that the commission will be examining, salmon farming is on that list. So that provides somewhat of a context for the many committee meetings that have been taking place in Ottawa addressing the Pacific salmon farming industry. On March 22nd, as an example, the Committee on Fisheries and Oceans spent a full 2 hours speaking with Trevor Swerdfager, the Director General for Aquaculture Management with the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, the DFO. And then on April 12th, BC wildlife biologist Alexandra Morton was invited to address the committee and share her research and opinions. Morton is, of course, a well-known guest and voice here on the show, and as is one of the focal points of her research, she addressed the impact that parasitic sea lice, which are incubated on salmon farms, are having on wild juvenile salmon. Alex has recently become very concerned with what her and others believe is the first sign of possible resistance among sea lice to the primary drug used to control them on salmon farms, a drug known as Slice. Alex joined the committee via teleconference only a week and a half prior to the start of her get-out migration recently featured here on the show, when her and hundreds of supporters walked down Vancouver Island to the BC capital, demanding that salmon farms be removed from BC's coastal waters.
I just want to say a little bit about sea lice. I'm a killer whale researcher, but sea lice are actually very easy to study. And the reason I say that is because they change their body shape every few days for the first month. So you can really, when you see a fish, you can see how long they've had each of those lice. And that's how we've been able to study. So we watch the little fish come out of the rivers and we check them at intervals and see how many lice they have. And typically they have no lice, and then they get to the fish farms and they have baby lice. And then as they go past the farms, the sea lice just mature. And then when they get to the next farm, they get more juvenile lice. So that's why it's been easy for us to figure out where the lice are getting on the fish. Now, the reason myself and many of my colleagues have such a strong opinion about the sea lice coming from the fish farms is because we've done experiments, not with the fish farmers really coming on side, but we work with them. So, for example, in an area where there's no farm fish 1 year, we'll count the number of lice on young fish. And then when they put the farm fish back, we count the lice on the young fish. And the pattern's really clear. So if you take the farm fish out, the lice go away. If you drug the farm fish, so you're killing the lice on the farm fish, the lice go away on the wild fish. when you put the farm fish back, the lice come back. If you look at one area in the same year and one area has no fish farms and the other has lots of fish farms, you get lice where there's farms, no lice where there's no farms. So we've done a lot of work for 10 years. And there was a little bit of a disturbing comment by Trevor Swerdfeger saying that this work had been seriously debunked. I would like to say they tried to debunk it, but we were allowed to publish our responses in the Journal of Science, which is arguably one of the two top journals in the world, very hard to get into, but they published DFO and they published our response back. So I think it's questionable whether it was debunked at all. Now, the question about drug resistance in lice, it's inevitable. As soon as you have a monoculture, the parasites increase because there's no predators and because all the hosts are packed together. So in the wild, sea lice have a very difficult life when they're young. They hatch and then they have to swim for a period of days before they even have the ability to grab a fish. So this means they never get on their mother's fish. That fish is long gone and they're lucky to find a fish at all. But when you take a salmon farm and you hold the fish stationary and you crowd them together and you put them in the inshore waters, you're breaking three very fundamental biological natural laws that govern wild salmon. Wild salmon are supposed to move. They're not supposed to be beside the rivers when the young ones come out, and they're not supposed to be crowded together. So what's happening now is the wild fish come in, and for sure, lice are natural. They have lice. They pass them to the farm fish, and then all the wild fish go into the rivers and they die. And this really brings down the lice population to nearly zero. But what happens now is as the wild fish go by the farms, the lice are passing to the farm fish. The wild ones go and die, but the farm ones don't, and they have lights on. And so the fish are crowded and stationary, and as the baby lice hatch, they find fish to attach to, and the lice numbers come up. And when you've got 600,000 to a million farm salmon in a school, it doesn't take very many lice on them to make billions of larval lice. Lice, like most parasites, reproduce rapidly. They're very fecund animal. So this means that there's many generations of lice, and when you treat them with the drug, you never kill all the lice. If you talk to fish farmers, they all realize you can't kill them all. And so the ones that survive are a little bit resistant to the drug, and they produce babies, and then as more drugs are used, of course, the resistance builds. So this is happening, a very serious problem in Norway. They're becoming resistant to all the drugs, both in the feed and bath treatments. East Coast Canada, Mr. Swerdfeger was debating whether DFO really recognized drug resistance there, but the fish farmers certainly recognize it. They now have three more drugs to use. And the trouble with these further drugs is the one we're using now is in a pellet. The fish eat it. It does come out when through the fish waste, but the other treatments are bath treatments. So they drop tarps and they pour the drug in, and it affects the outside of the fish, but then they lift the tarps and this goes into the water. In the areas where they're salmon farming in British Columbia, we have very, very viable prawn, crab, shrimp, other fisheries that are fishing for animals with a shell. And all these drugs that they use on the lice attack animals with a shell. So I'm really happy to answer all your questions. I also want to just point out, sea lice are just the easy pathogen to study, but the same dynamic is occurring with bacteria and viruses. They get in, they intensify like they do in all feedlots, and then they challenge the wild fish at a higher level than they're designed to take.
Alexandra Morton, speaking on April 12th to Canada's Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans. Among the 12 members of Parliament who sit on the committee is Jerry Byrne, the MP for the Newfoundland riding of Humber, St. Barbe, Baie Verte.
Would you be able to categorize for us the opinions expressed by other groups other than yourself? Would you be able to categorize the opinion, for example, of the Canadian Veterinarian Association? Have they expressed an opinion? I know that the veterinarians are involved in aquaculture, so obviously the Canadian Veterinarian Association will necessarily be involved in the aquaculture industry. Have they expressed any opinion about this whatsoever? Because we're dealing with a very technical science here, drug resistance. What has been their opinion in your mind?
I haven't heard their opinion on sea lice in general, but I am dealing with Dr. Mark Shepherd at the province, and he is a veterinarian who's in charge of this, and he is saying there is no evidence of drug resistance anywhere in British Columbia. But I keep writing him back saying, well, the graphs on your website, on the Ministry of Agriculture and Lands website for the area of concern are, for a scientist, they're a neon sign warning drug resistance. And the reason I say that is because they had very high lice levels in this area on those Greek farms. They treated in October and the lice levels came down to 3 times the provincial limit, 9, an average of 9 per fish. And then they bounced right back up. And so I've asked him, what is your explanation for that behavior in the lice after the treatment? And they keep saying, you know, they won't answer. They just keep saying, we're looking into it, or it's a concern, or we don't see any evidence. But he won't tell me why that happened. Now, there's actually an audio clip on CBC by Dr. Larry Hamill from Prince Edward, PEI, the University of PEI. And he describes what drug resistant looks like in sea lice, and he describes exactly what's on those charts in the on the Ministry of Agriculture and Lands website. So, quite frankly, they're not answering the question, and I don't see how you can look at those graphs and not see drug resistance.
We'll come back to Alexandra Morton later on the show, but let's continue on this issue of drug resistance among sea lice to the primary product used, slice, a product which should be noted is not approved for use in Canada, but is nevertheless used through an ongoing stream of emergency veterinary approvals that salmon farm companies are able to apply for. Mark Shepherd, who Alexandra Morton referred to, was too invited to address the committee 2 days later on April 14th. Mark Shepherd is the senior aquatic animal health veterinarian for BC's Ministry of Agriculture and Lands. Shepherd is heard here, fielding a question from Scott Andrews, the Liberal MP for the Newfoundland-Labrador riding of Avalon.
A question here from one of our analysts put together. We heard evidence that tolerance to slice, an antiparasitic parasitic drug used to treat sea lice infection, was not a problem in British Columbia. Can you confirm that this is the case, and how do you test for this type of drug tolerance? Are you familiar?
Yes, and again, I will reiterate that there is no evidence to substantiate that allegation that there is drug resistance to slice by lice in British Columbia. To make such a claim, in my opinion, is misleading and quite frankly irresponsible. It's a complex issue, drug resistance and the development of it, and there are a myriad of other factors that need to be considered before putting it on the list. Now, it is on the list. It would be on the very bottom of the list as a likelihood of what to how it, one would explain why slice treatment did not work.
Mark Shepherd's response certainly triggered a flashback to some of our previous episodes here on Deconstructing Dinner on the subject of genetically engineered food in particular, where the heated debate on that issue is too often met with the common argument that there is, quote, no evidence to substantiate the allegation that GE foods are harmful to humans. As was suggested here on the show then, and as we'll suggest once again, it must be one of the most unscientific statements to make that there is, quote, no evidence to substantiate something, if at the same time there isn't anyone looking. With GE food as an example, there haven't been any ongoing studies on the impact GE foods might have on humans, just as there hasn't been anyone checking for drug resistance among sea lice in BC. And so in both cases, stating that there is, quote, no evidence is a pretty misinforming statement, especially to the unscientific ear, as it suggests that there have indeed been efforts to test that hypothesis. With the questionable statements being made by the Ministry of Agriculture and Lands, Mark Shepherd, Member of Parliament Finn Donnelly continued pressing Shepherd about the graph that was released by the province that suggested to Alexandra Morton that drug resistance should be tested for. The NDP's Finn Donnelly represents the BC riding of New Westminster, Coquitlam, Port Moody. In his response, Shepherd alludes to Alexandra Morton's position as, quote, wildly speculative.
In one of the handouts in the background information, there's reference to, it says from a strictly medical perspective, the drug protects, this is talking about slice, the drug protects fish from lice for a short period goes on to say if medicated fish are exposed to unmedicated lice a second time, those lice may reinfest the recently medicated fish. The situation as it's recently occurred in the Nootka area is not evidence of drug resistance, even though some may interpret it that way. A couple of questions on that. One, I'm wondering if you could describe what drug resistance looks like, so that this is not drug resistance in your opinion. What does drug resistance look like? And secondly, why are some saying that this is, in their opinion, evidence or a case of resistance to slice?
Right, both good questions. If I may answer the second question first. The development of drug resistance is an extremely complex phenomenon. And what some people who, in my opinion, are not qualified to make comment on it have decided to put forth a wildly speculative conclusion based on a graph which I think I explained to you have many other factors that needed to be considered before any conclusion was made on that point. So that case in itself is just a matter of someone who either doesn't understand the science, or they simply preferred to move forth with a perspective to suit their agenda. The drug resistance, what it looks like, if you'd like, you know, I can refer to antibiotic resistance in bacteria, or is your question, Mr. Donnelly, specific about lice?
Slice.
Okay, so slice in lice. Oh, by the way, for those who don't know, slice is the trade name for a drug, which is the generic name for that drug is emamectin benzoate. It's used in different countries. It's very effective at killing all life stages of the lice when it works. In other countries, it's used multiple times each year. You know, for example, every 6 weeks sometimes. In BC, as I said, we use it once a year normally. Drug resistance can develop if there is a repetitive use of the product numerous times over short periods, and if the drug is not effective at killing all of the lice or all of the bacteria, those animals that survive, the lice or the bacteria, have then the opportunity to pass on their genetic protection, resistance of the drug to the offspring. And so when the drug is used again, there's more protection, or more animals survive, and they keep passing on that genetics. It takes quite some period of time before drug resistance will develop in a population of parasites or bacteria. And unfortunately, that is what we're seeing is failed treatments in other parts of the world, where they are using slice on numerous occasions, and unfortunately the lice, again, now we're talking here about Atlantic Ocean louse, the very different animal than we have in British Columbia, and so that's what they're seeing. And as a result, they're having to use alternate products to try to control their lice infestations on their fish. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
If it hasn't, then I can see that without the depth of knowledge to look at a graph to see that there's a peak, there's a medication, then there's another peak. Yes, I suppose if we had drug resistance, that might be what it looked like. But I would still go through the other 20 factors first before making that conclusion.
Mark Shepherd of British Columbia's Ministry of Agriculture and Lands. Now, what stands as perhaps the most curious comment made by Shepherd, requiring some deconstructing, was that very last one. MP Finn Donnelly had referred to the same graph that biologist Alexandra Morton had looked at that was suggestive to her that resistance to slice among sea lice might be a reason for the drug not working. Now, while Mark Shepard insisted that Morton had come to a, quote, conclusion, that the lice were resistant, never at any point did she conclude anything. We went back over her statements and responses made to the committee and have confirmed that she only stated that the graph is a, quote, neon sign warning of drug resistance, and on another occasion stating, I don't see how you can look at those graphs and not see drug resistance, end quote. Now, the statements are no doubt strong, but were only a plea for the province or the Department of Fisheries and Oceans to test for drug resistance, as she explained both in committee and through email communications with Mark Shepard in the months prior. That email communication is documented on Alexandra Morton's blog, linked to from the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca. While Shepard used very strong words to dismiss what Morton was interpreting from the graph, Donnelly maintained his line of questioning, asking whether or not drug resistance among the sea lice would result in the graph that Morton and Shepard are referring to. At least, would it look that way? It was that persistence by Donnelly that resulted in what seems to us here at Deconstructing Dinner to be an agreement. That yes, the graph that Morton believes should warrant drug resistance tests is indeed suggestive of possible drug resistance. Here's that comment again.
Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Well, if I may, if it hasn't been, I can see that without the depth of knowledge to look at a graph to see that there's a peak, there's a medication, then there's another peak. Yes, I suppose if we had drug resistance, that might be what it looked like. But I would still go through the other 20 factors first before making that conclusion.
Now, no indication of what those other 20 factors are was made, but given the serious repercussions of drug resistance, it would seem that any indication of that resistance should warrant a response. Instead, as can be viewed on Alexandra Morton's blog, her email communication with Mark Shepard and his supervisor Trevor Rhodes indicates a very different response and a very difficult effort trying to convince the British Columbia government that drug resistance should be looked into. Despite Shepard agreeing that drug resistance would indeed produce a graph like the one released by the province, British Columbia's Director of Aquaculture Operations Trevor Rhodes wrote to Morton with the following statement, that there is, quote, no indication that sea lice in Nootka Sound or elsewhere in BC are resistant to slice, end quote. This despite his colleague stating, as we just heard, that the graph is very much an indication of possible resistance. Now, it's this topic of discussion from Canada's Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans that has mobilized at least one group to go on the defense for fish farms and challenge Morton's testimony to the committee. A group calling itself Positive Aquaculture Awareness issued a statement on their website about the hearings. Based in the unofficial capital of salmon farming, Campbell River, the group is referred to by its supporters as a, quote, grassroots organization. But upon a closer look, it is more or less a front group for the salmon farming industry made up of industry professionals. Their president, as an example, is the plant manager of Noboco, one of the major producers of styrofoam packaging for the fish farming industry. Their vice president is with Campbell River's Economic Development Corporation. Their secretary is the production manager of Grieg Seafood, the company in question over possible sea lice resistance on their farm. And of their two education staff, one works for a Norwegian company producing steel frames for fish farm cages, and the other works for Walcan, the seafood processing plant that Grieg Seafood sends some of their product to. In their statement made on their website, Positive Aquaculture Awareness writes, quote, her allegations of slice-resistant sea lice, likely presence of infectious salmon anemia on marine harvest salmon farms, and general proliferation of disease at salmon farms were as shocking as they were untrue, end quote. Now, that statement is a pretty shocking one, to say the least, because upon deconstructing it, the statement is quite flawed. Because allegations, as the group says, were made by Morton, can never be untrue, as the group states. Just as allegations are also never true. Allegations, after all, rest in the middle, waiting to be proven or disproven. Alexandra Morton was indeed alleging sea lice resistance and alleging the likely presence of infectious salmon anemia. Never were her statements stated as fact, as Positive Aquaculture Awareness says in their statement on their website. It appears as yet another public relations strategy and some serious spin being placed on the statements made in Canada's Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans. On May 12, 2010, about a month after Alexandra Morton testified to the Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans, Lawrence Dill was also invited to testify. Dill is a professor emeritus in the Department of Biological Sciences at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. Dill shared his thoughts on Mark Shepherd's testimony to the committee, following a question from Member of Parliament Finn Donnelly.
Thank you. And we've had experts in front of us here, or professionals in front of this committee, that have said, you know, essentially sea lice is not a problem on the West Coast with respect to aquaculture and wild salmon. And I even asked about the potential of developing resistance to slice. And I'm wondering if you could comment on either of those.
I'll comment on the resistance to slice first. I felt that Dr. Shepherd's commentary on that was highly irresponsible and very unscientific when he said that there's no evidence for it and I would put it number 20 on the list of possibilities, something like that. But resistance to slice has happened elsewhere. It's happened in Chile, it's happened in Norway, it's happened in eastern Canada. And there was a report yesterday that came out of the Sea Lice 2010 Congress that's going on here in Victoria, that it is highly likely in BC. In fact, there are some signs in BC that the process may have already started. And there's certainly no evidence to the contrary because no one has done the experiments. So it's inappropriate to discuss that possibility without studying it first.
Lawrence Dill, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Biological Sciences at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. Dill's opening remarks to the committee, not heard here, are archived alongside today's episode on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca. And another witness who testified on May 12th and spoke about the risks of resistance to slice among sea lice was Craig Orr of the Watershed Watch Salmon Society. We'll hear more from Craig Orr's opening remarks later on the show, but first here's his response to a question from Conservative MP Blaine Culkins that inquired into the International Sea Lice Conference that took place in Victoria in early May. Craig's comments indicate that resistance to slice among sea lice is indeed a very real concern.
You know, I was at a session yesterday at Sea Lice 2010. It's called Resistance, and it had titles like Reduced Sensitivity to Emamectin Benzoate in Farm Population of Sea Lice, Increased Tolerance Towards Emamectin Benzoate Versus Fitness in Lab-Reared Sea Lice, et cetera, et cetera. But the plenary talk was given by Professor Tor Horsberg from the Norwegian School of Veterinary Science in Norway, and he's a pharmacologist who's studied this for a number of years. He's a world's authority. And he showed us the problems that were happening in Norway. And one of the things that he said was that slice wasn't working in 1999, wasn't working in this last year. And it's the last chemical that's been developed. And it was developed in 1999. So it's, you know, we're talking something that's 11 years out of date now, you know, in terms of recent developments. He did say that they were working on vaccines for fish, for sea lice, but as far as he knew, and he should know, there was nothing in the pipeline for vaccines right now. He was quite worried about the efficacy of slice, obviously, as were many of the other people, but he talked about how they had to resort to other ways that were used in the past to deal with lice, including organophosphates like DDT, those kind of things, chitin disruptors. And one of the things that Norway does, too, is they take boats around to these farms that are closed boats, and they have a hydrogen peroxide bath that they put these fish in to kill the lice. But all these things have limitations on what they do in terms of killing lice, and Norway has a problem. And I also sat down to lunch yesterday with Dr. Karine Boxespen, who's a major sea louse researcher in Norway. And she said the only reason they actually saved some fish last year in terms of the wild fish is because they had an exceptional cold snap which killed off some of the lice. And she said it would have been far worse without, you know, the weather assist in terms of killing lice. So we have problems. Even though we spend 300 million euros a year, and that's from the paper that I told you before by Costello, you know, we have considerable problems in killing lice off in a way that's, you know, sufficient to save wild fish. And the Sea Lice Action Plan that they have in Norway, Peter Herk is the leading expert on that. He was at the conference as well. And he's shown as the farms get larger and larger, they have more and more problems, you know, with these chemical treatments. They just do not do the job, and they have been unable to recover their wild fish in Norway because of salmon farming.
Craig Orr of the Watershed Watch Salmon Society. This is Deconstructing Dinner, produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. You're listening to part 7 of our ongoing series, Norway, British Columbia, a series examining the salmon farming industry on the British Columbia coast, an industry made up mostly of three Norwegian multinationals. On today's show, we're listening in on sessions of Canada's Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans, where over the past few months, the subject of salmon farming in BC has been discussed in depth, in part because of the now in-process transferring of regulatory authority from the province of BC to the federal government and the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. If you're new to the series, that transfer was the result of a successful legal challenge initiated by a number of groups, including biologist Alexandra Morton, who we heard earlier and who we'll hear again later on the show. But first, another witness invited to address the committee and field questions was Craig Orr, who we just heard a small clip of. Orr is the executive director of the Coquitlam, BC-based Watershed Watch Salmon Society. Here again is Craig Orr and his opening comments to the parliamentary committee.
My involvement in the interactions of wild and farmed salmon goes back to about 1999, but in particular, it geared up quite a bit in 2001 when we saw the first ever sea lice outbreaks on juvenile Pacific salmon on the coast of British Columbia. Since that time, my major focus has been on aquaculture and aquaculture interactions between wild and farmed fish. I've helped organize 7 international workshops as the Associate Director for the Center of Coastal Studies at Simon Fraser and also the Executive Director of Watershed Watch. And we brought in scientists from around the world to share their experiences and their science around the impacts of sea lice. In 2004, we began working with the largest salmon farming company in Canada and in the world, actually, Stolt Sea Farms, now Marine Harvest Canada. And the goals of that work were to improve understanding and the transparency around the data from salmon farms and also the interactions between wild and farmed fish, and to undertake management actions that would reduce infection pressures on wild fish. Part of that work involved monitoring lice on some of the marine harvest farms in 2006 on a weekly basis during the outmigration of juvenile fish, and also looking at the effects of biocides on those lice. And that is coming out as a paper shortly. I published also several other papers on farm wild salmon interactions, in particular looking at the production of lice on salmon farms. So in that work, and in particular in the workshops that we've hosted with Simon Fraser, we've built up a considerable weight of evidence and reviewed the science around the impacts of salmon farms around the world. What we know from that science, you may have already heard some of this, and I apologize if it's redundant, that we know that 95% of the lice in coastal waters around the world come from salmon farms. They are actually manufacturing lots of lice because of the high density of farm fish. You have to understand that our salmon farms on this coast are extremely large. The typical farm is about 725,000 farm salmon, much larger than the farms in Europe. And just to put that in perspective, that's a mass equivalent of about 500 Asian bull elephants swimming around in a farm. So we've looked at that science. We've looked at the fact that we've altered the natural ecology of our coastal oceans. In particular, what we've done is we've reversed the natural laws of what's called migration allopatry. And what that simply means is that juvenile fish, when they leave rivers, and they're quite small when they leave the rivers, the juvenile pink and chum salmon weigh less than a gram when they emerge from the gravel and go to sea. But typically, those juvenile fish did not encounter, over historic times, large numbers of adult lice-bearing salmon in coastal waters. Those adult salmon were in the high seas feeding at the time, and although they may have hosted several lice per fish, They weren't shedding those lice eggs while the juveniles were going by. So there's a separation, migration allopatry, between the wild juvenile fish and the adult fish when we had a natural ecology on this coast. Right now we cultivate farm fish, and the evidence suggests that they are producing substantial numbers of lice. I published a paper in 2007 in North American Journal of Fisheries Management looking at production patterns on marine harvest farms. We waited several years prodding Fisheries and Oceans Canada, who had those data, to publish them, and they did not, so we undertook it ourselves. And what we showed, or what I showed in this paper, was that these farms, just eight farms we were looking at, were producing billions of lice eggs and infectious larvae every year. In particular, they were producing spikes, very large spikes of lice, just before the juvenile fish migrated past the farms. And we're still seeing this pattern to this day in the western Canada. Some of the other science backs me up on the fact that we're seeing large productions of lice from these farms. In 2009, Mark Costello, a leading researcher in New Zealand, in a paper in Public Library Science, said that there's no doubt that salmon farms are the major source of sea lice epizootics observed on wild fish around the world. Epizootics. We had a workshop in which all the scientists came together in 2007 in Alert Bay in British Columbia and said there's no doubt that salmon farms cause impacts around the world. And that was true from Ireland, Scotland, Norway. The statement of expectation, which is printed in a workshop proceedings, also said it's time to act to deal with these impacts. The situation in British Columbia is particularly exacerbated by the small size and vulnerability of the pink salmon and chum salmon in particular, but we have seen lice on all species of Pacific salmon, all six, including steelhead. There are also papers out there that show population levels of effect. Several papers have looked at the effects of lice on individual fish. It's a little harder to translate those into population level impacts. But in particular, I draw your attention to a paper done by Jennifer Ford and the late Ransom Myers of Dalhousie University, published in 2009, again in a Public Library of Science, which they did a paired bay comparison of salmon farms around the world. And what that means is they looked at areas in Ireland, Scotland, Norway, and in British Columbia. They looked at one bay, there was no salmon farms, and they looked at one bay where there were salmon farms, and that way they were able to control for all sources of mortality. And what they said very conclusively in this peer-reviewed paper was that salmon farms are the major source of declines of wild fish around the world. Their meta-analysis left no doubt of that. And in fact, they found that on average, wherever there was salmon farming, there was a 50% decline in wild fish survival around the world. British Columbia is simply the latest place where this is happening in the world.
Craig Orr, the executive director of the Watershed Watch Salmon Society based in Coquitlam, British Columbia. Craig addressed Canada's Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans on May 12, 2010. Now, one of the topics that has come up here on the show before and came up quite often during the past few months that the committee has been studying British Columbia's salmon farms has been the role of Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans in promoting salmon farming and their role in protecting wild salmon stocks. Previous guests, like Otto Langer, formerly of the DFO, shared many critical reflections and perspectives that questioned the department's credibility and their ability to adequately carry out their mandate. Langer left the department along with many other DFO scientists because of those concerns. In his opening remarks to the Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans, Craig Orr also did not mince words, stating that the actions of DFO staff sometimes leave him embarrassed to be a Canadian. He refers to published pieces by scientists like Martin Kirkosik, who, despite demonstrating peer-reviewed research on the negative impacts of salmon farms on wild salmon, is seemingly dismissed by DFO scientists. The latest came from the Sea Lice Conference that Orr attended in early May.
Unfortunately, although there are papers like this out there, there was also a recent one by Dr. Marty Kirkosik in Science, the journal Science, one of the preeminent journals in the world, showing rapid declines in the survival of pink salmon in the Broughton Archipelago. We have a very large amount of debate still happening in British Columbia. In fact, I just saw that debate rear its ugly head again at the workshop, where we had the senior scientist from DFO, Dr. Dick Beamish, refusing to answer any questions whatsoever at a sea lice workshop on whether sea lice were causing impacts on wild fish. So, it's a debate that's been going on for far too long, and the science on this coast has been ignored and distorted, in particular by management agencies, to a point where it's embarrassing to be a Canadian at times to see the kind of science that is coming out of our federal government. In fact, some resource ecologists studying these problems around the world call this resource management pathology, and it's a recurring situation around the world. And let me just sum it up. I can't sum it up any more eloquently than the great Buzz Holling, a preeminent Canadian ecologist who lives in Nanaimo. And he says this, He says, while science uses uncertainty to drive the engine of inquiry, vested interests use uncertainty to maintain the status quo. And this is clearly demonstrated, probably more so in the Sea Lice Communications Plan that came out a few years ago, in which the communications branch of Fisheries and Oceans urged its scientists, when they were talking about this situation in the public, to extol the complexity of ecosystems and the need for more research before we can definitively, ascribe these losses of wild fish to salmon farms. And this is, again, carried on to heights that were absolutely absurd. And the last piece of evidence I'll bring before I bring this to a conclusion is a recent criticism of Dr. Dick Beamish, who published a paper called The Proposed Life History Strategy for the Salmon Louse in the Subarctic Pacific. And he published this in the journal Aquaculture, which is not a well-known ecology journal where you normally publish this paper. But he talked about alternate life history strategies where these sea lice were coming from. Of course, we heard back from DFO back in the mid-2000s that sea lice were coming from wild fish. They were coming from sticklebacks. They were coming from everywhere except salmon farms. And so an academic, Dr. Dill, whom I believe you just heard from, wrote a review of Beamish's paper. And I'll just cite a couple lines, and I'll finish off on that. Beamish's paper is curious in failing to mention farm salmon host in the Broughton Archipelago, and this is in a paper that looks at alternate life history strategies of sea lice, despite this being the only place on the coast where newly emerged wild fry are heavily parasitized. Beamish's errors of omission and their selective use of their own and others' data lead the naive reader to a conclusion that cannot be substantiated, their conclusion that the transport of lice in the coastal areas is an evolutionary adaptation is unwarranted and, indeed, is not a conclusion at all. In fact, the presence of farm salmon along the migration routes of very young wild salmon represents an anthropogenic or human perturbation to a natural host parasite system. And, these are pretty strong statements from an academic. Unfortunately, we still don't seem to have our federal government on side. We have had, of course, our Auditor General twice cite Fisheries and Oceans as being in a conflict of interest because they're primarily or they're simultaneously trying to promote salmon farming and also protect wild salmon. So, unfortunately, we've had a lot of problems around getting the clear science out there, which is probably why we're at this session right now. But there is really no doubt that salmon farms are exacerbating the problems with wild salmon around the world, mainly through sea lice, but also through disease. And I haven't touched on the other issues of escape fish, also pollutants. We did publish a paper as well looking at how mercury is transported through the feed and then biomagnified back up through the food chain and appears in rockfish around the salmon farms. So there are other problems with salmon farms, but all the researchers that we talked to suggest that sea lice are a major problem around the world and that the treatments for those sea lice are starting to fail. We just heard from researcher after researcher from Norway, Scotland, and Ireland saying their treatments for sea lice are failing, and we can expect the same to happen here. Thank you.
Craig Orr of the Watershed Watch Salmon Society. Orr was one of a number of witnesses addressing the Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans and who spoke very critically of Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans, suggesting that the department is in a conflict of interest with a mandate to both protect wild salmon and promote salmon farms. To the untrained eye, that conflict of interest and the confusion that might arise both within the department and among Canadians is quite obvious when paying a visit to DFO's very own website. On it, they maintain a page titled Myths and Realities About Salmon Farming. The page goes on to list 16 myths, among which are these five. The DFO says on that page that it is a myth that, quote, farm salmon spread disease to wild salmon, end quote. Now this despite the opposite being true, such as one of the first known instances of disease transfer in Norway decades ago, when furunculosis spread from farms to wild stocks. The DFO also says it is a, quote, myth that sea lice from farm salmon are destroying pink salmon stocks in BC, end quote. Again, this despite, as heard just earlier, the work of Martin Kirkosik, who published those very findings in the Journal of Science. The DFO says it is a, quote, myth that food fish are being taken away from wild stocks to feed farmed fish, end quote. Now, this is perhaps one of the most blatant lies of them all, because there is absolutely no question that wild food fish are consistently used to feed farmed fish. So the origin of that statement is quite a mystery. And again, this is Canada's very own Department of Fisheries and Oceans making these statements. So what else does the DFO say is a myth on that page? Well, they say that it's a myth that, quote, the science on the aquaculture issue seems confusing, end quote. Yet, as Craig Orr identified, the very sea lice communication strategy for the DFO essentially encourages them to confuse the public by inserting the talking points of complexity and that more research is needed. And the last myth that we have time here on the show to address is DFO stating that it is a, quote, myth that farmed salmon are pumped full of hormones and antibiotics, end quote. Well, we did not need to go far to find a paper published in 2007 by the DFO's very own Les Burridge, who writes, quote, in British Columbia, the quantity of antibiotics prescribed per metric ton of production is also very high compared to Norway or Scotland. It has been suggested that this use of large volumes of antibiotics can only be explained by excessive and prophylactic use, end quote. Again, that from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Les Burridge. And again, the DFO on their website stating that it is a, quote, myth that farmed salmon are pumped full of hormones and antibiotics. This is Deconstructing Dinner. As heard earlier, wildlife biologist Alexandra Morton also appeared before Canada's Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans, and she too was questioned on the work and statements of DFO scientists. In particular was this question from NDP Member of Parliament Finn Donnelly on the collapse of the Fraser River sockeye in 2009.
I just want to read a comment that was we heard at this committee. And, aquaculture is one of the possible causes for the decline of the Fraser River sockeye last year that was devastated. And at a recent hearing, the committee heard that DFO did not, quote, have information that suggests that the presence of fish farms is causing a decline in the wild salmon populations in British Columbia right now, unquote. I'm wondering if you could comment on that statement.
Yes. DFO is a bit schizophrenic at this point. I would say the guys on the grounds are seeing evidence, but that information never seems to get to the top. And so the fact that the DFO has no evidence, that's in my mind irrelevant. First of all, they don't know what diseases is on these farms. Second of all, they had a front seat on the sea lice epidemics of the Broughton. There was enormous evidence that it was the fish farms because in 2003 they took all the farms off the migration route and the number of pink salmon that survived and came back from that generation was greater than has ever been recorded in the history of studying pink salmon. And that's a paper actually by Dr. Dick Beamish. But what Beamish took from that study was that fish farms and wild salmon can survive together. Well, that was a very flawed jump in reasoning because, in fact, what had happened that year was the fish farms had been removed. So there's a lot of evidence that the farms are affecting the wild salmon, and there's a tremendous number of holes in our knowledge about what is going on these farms for viruses and bacteria.
Alexandra Morton. Now, some of the criticism that Alexandra Morton often receives questions her very vocal focus on sea lice as being the main culprit in the decline of wild salmon stocks. This concern was raised by Liberal MP Jerry Byrne.
I think we all recognize there's probably a number of different causes or sources of population decline or disappearance in terms of Fraser River sockeye. Would you categorize the explosion in sea lice population in key areas, key transit areas, as being the critical cause for wild salmon population decline?
I would expand that to pathogen explosion, because a lot of fish farmers now come to me directly and talk to me and tell me what goes on in these farms, and I unfortunately can't do much with that information because they don't want to be revealed, they won't tell me the exact sites sometimes, but the impression I have very clearly is that there's large bacterial and viral outbreaks on these salmon farms. There was a paper written by Dr. Sonia Saxida that described a massive outbreak of the virus IHN from 2001 through 2003 that infected 12 million farm salmon. And the Fraser sockeye swam through that, and that was the 2005 generation that crashed so badly. Now, the really key thing about those Fraser sockeye, there's a pattern there we should be reading. All of the stocks that have been genetically observed going north past Campbell River and the 60 salmon farms from there to the open ocean, they are in steep decline. But the one stock that is observed genetically going out the bottom of Vancouver Island, they're called the Harrison, they're actually increasing. And if you pull back your focus, the Somas River coming out of Alberni Inlet on the west coast of Vancouver Island goes by no salmon farms, goes straight into the Pacific Ocean. That run of sockeye came back at more than twice what DFO forecast, as well as the Columbia River to the south and the Okanagan River, which feed into the Columbia. Those sockeye go straight into the Pacific Ocean. They're in the same latitude, and they did extremely well. They passed no fish farms. So that pattern to me says, A, there was a serious problem in the eastern coast of Vancouver Island, and B, that's where all the salmon farms are. We absolutely need to know what pathogens were on those farms, or we will never answer this question. There's also processing plants spewing blood water into these areas. Some kids went down and videoed the Walcan one on Quadra Island. They put my plankton net right over the end of the pipe. And, you know, like it or not, they bottled it all up, put it in a cooler for me to check. And coming out of that pipe were sea lice hatching. They were actually alive. It's the first time I've actually seen sea lice hatch. So that suggests viruses and bacteria coming out that pipe, too. All of that is so incredibly risky to our Fraser sockeye. And the fact that only those stocks that are going through that area are in decline is a huge warning sign. And if we really want to protect those fish, we need to pull those farms out right now and just test and see what happens. But at the very least, we need to know exactly what was going on in them.
Alexandra Morton of the Echo Bay, British Columbia-based Raincoast Research Society. Morton spoke to Canada's Standing Committee on Fisheries and Oceans on April 12, 2010. Full transcripts from all of the recent hearings on salmon farming that have taken place between March and May of this year are archived on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca and the June 10, 2010 episode. You'll also find many resources on today's topic, including unheard audio from those committee hearings. And to close out this part 7 of our Norway-British Columbia series, we have here a collage of clips, some of which are from the hearings, including Simon Fraser University's Lawrence Dill, the Watershed Watch Salmon Society's Craig Orr, and the Raincoast Research Society's Alexandra Morton. Leading off the clips is an unheard segment from Deconstructing Dinner's October 2008 visit to a marine harvest salmon farm off of East Thurlow Island. It was there where the BC Ministry of Agriculture and Lands Bill Harrower fielded a question from myself on the sea lice drug known as Slice. His comments are suggestive that British Columbia's sea lice monitoring program is merely to appease the public and to not genuinely protect wild salmon, a reality that would actually make sense, because the province has never been responsible for the health of wild salmon. In the background, helping Harrower answer the question, is the BC Salmon Farmers Association's Paula Galloway.
Here, the reason for using Slice at all is to just ensure to the public and First Nations that there is a very low risk of transmitting lice from farms. That's the only reason it's used, because it has never posed a fish health risk to the fish on the farms here. Whereas,
so you're doing prevention for...
But not for fish health, for not public relations so much, but to assure the public that we're doing everything that can be done to safeguard wild stocks.
Right.
So contrary to the absolute nonsense claimed by provincial veterinarian Mark Shepherd, there are a rather large number of credible scientists, myself included, who disagree with him when he says there is insufficient information to suggest that lice on farms is affecting Pacific salmon in a detrimental way. Now, I said earlier that science never proves anything absolutely. There's always a small element of uncertainty. It may be very small, but no matter how small, it's inappropriate to seize on this uncertainty to discredit the work. Seizing on uncertainty is a common tactic of people who don't want to believe the results, from climate change deniers to tobacco companies. It's a bogus argument. The conclusions that science is coming to are more than strongly enough supported that DFO should be invoking the precautionary principle and getting the salmon farms out of the migration routes of wild salmon. Thank you very much.
I've been out in the Broughton Archipelago, a beautiful and remote area, for 26 years, and I just want to tell you, the oceans are not dying. When I arrived there, there was no humpback whales. There's now 27 whales that use the area. The sand lance population, which is a very, very energy-rich fish, is bigger than it's ever been. Nobody's seen it this big. We got pilchard back, who were gone for like 90 years. The Pacific white-sided dolphin population is in the thousands. A lot is going right in our oceans. And the fact that our salmon are declining when the Western Pacific and the Alaskan ones are not, it's an indication that we can fix this. And I so hope you let us do this, because if fishery management became more localized and DFO became an organization that worked with people, and you took the scientists out of the political body of DFO and you let them be what they were as the Fisheries Research Board, they were cutting edge. They were the leading fishery scientists of the world. If we just took a few simple steps here, Canada could be an example around the world of how we could have our fish and our communities could thrive. And your committee, having me here today, thank you so much. And I see a lot of movement happening, and I'm hoping we can all follow through and solve this, because it's not about anybody losing. We all win. The Norwegians, if they got to go home, they'll still fish farm. Those European shareholders will be fine. It's the communities of British Columbia we need to be concerned about.
I'd like to say that, you know, humans are notorious for resisting change, and they cling to outdated ideas and practices, even though they know that these are damaging. You can look at all kinds of human behaviors that are self-destructive, and I won't go into those. But there's been many studies looking at this from an ecological standpoint. And one of the biggest drivers to get somebody to change is they finally get into a crisis so deep that they have to look themselves in the eye, you know, in the mirror and say, we have to change. And we've had a crisis with our Fraser sockeye. We've had the worst returns on record last year in the Fraser River. And to the Minister Shea's credit, she called an inquiry into the problems here. We've had a crisis with salmon farming on this coast, which is the main reason why we're seeing some change on this coast. And it's not happening fast enough to save certain stocks of fish. So we should be looking at why people resist change. And, there's lots of literature out there on that. But we do have a crisis. We have to change, and it has to happen fairly soon. He says, while science uses uncertainty to drive the engine of inquiry, vested interests use uncertainty to maintain the status quo. And this is clearly demonstrated, probably more so in the Sea Lice Communications Plan that came out a few years ago, in which the communications branch of Fisheries and Oceans urged its scientists, when they were talking about this situation in the public, to extol the complexity of ecosystems and the need for more research before we can definitively, you know, ascribe these losses of wild fish to salmon farms.
So that this is not drug resistance, in your opinion. What does drug resistance look like? And secondly, why are some saying that this is, in their opinion, evidence or a case of resistance to slice?
If I may answer the second question first, the development of drug resistance is an extremely complex phenomenon.
And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson, area resident Adam Shake. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.